This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Meth is the most talked about illegal substance since crack cocaine, the devil drug of the new millennium, writes Frank Owen in his new book, No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. Owen's book is all about methamphetamine, why people take it in the first place, and how it turns against them. He looks at how bikers started to make and distribute meth, why mom and pop meth labs developed around the country, and how federal laws succeeded in shutting down many of those labs. But there's still plenty of meth out there. Much of the business has been taken over by Mexican drug traffickers. Frank Owen grew up in Manchester, England. He's written for The New York Times, The Village Voice, Newsday, Spin, Vibe, and Playboy. Frank Owen, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your introduction to meth wasn't as a journalist. It was as a user years ago. Mm-hmm. Tell us what a meth high is like in the honeymoon phase.
Well, the thing about meth is it actually doesn't get you that high, except not in the conventional sense of the word, not in the dosages I was using. It actually makes you feel more sober. It kind of focuses concentration. You feel you have boundless amounts of energy. You feel you're ready for any task. So it doesn't get you like stoned. You don't feel out of it. It doesn't take you to some distant region of your mind. It's not about losing control. It's exactly the opposite. And that was initially the appeal of the drug to me, because I used it essentially as a vocational aid, as a work tool.
Well, it helped you write.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, like, most stimulants, like cocaine, for instance, to me, that blurs the senses. You can't kind of concentrate. You have to do a line every 20 minutes. Meth is kind of like set it and forget it. You can do it, and you don't have to think about it for 8 hours. And it actually has been proven to, focus concentration. So you can read, very dense tomes, very dense books, and you can get through them very, very fast. It's very good for writer's block. You don't get writer's block on meth. It also has this strange ability to make kind of mundane work seem fascinating. So that was, the initial attraction of the drug to me.
When did meth start to go bad for you?
Well, maybe 3 or 4 months into it. The problem with meth is that, after a while, you suffer from these sleep deprivation hallucinations. And if you stay up for two or three days, even if you're not on meth, you stay up for 2 or 3 days, you're going to get some very vivid hallucinations. And that's not so much because of the drug, but because of the lack of sleep. And meth hallucinations are very real and very scary. They're not like LSD hallucinations. On LSD, they're not real. Meth hallucinations seem like they're really happening. And they're very much based in reality. They're not kind of freaky out there kind of hallucinations. They're stuff that's basically, elements from your reality kind of, exaggerated and made to seem fantastic.
And when things started to go bad with you and meth, was it helpful still for you as a writer?
Well, it's as with any drug, there's a kind of law of diminishing returns. It's always better at the beginning than it is at the end. But as the drug took over, I found myself becoming very increasingly irritated at the world, very angry, getting into fights with people. And what started out as something I did to help me work actually ended up negatively affecting the work. I would kind of miss deadlines and things like that. And also the effect on my health. I turned practically spectral from doing all this meth. Clothes that I'd bought, that originally fit me started to hang off me like funeral shrouds, And also the paranoia. You can get very, very paranoid on meth. And so I'd imagine people following me in the street. I'd think that people were taking pictures of me from the fire escape across the street. I'd hear voices in the hallway, children's voices whispering my name, and I'd go out there and there'd be nobody there. The paranoia, the anger, all that stuff really starts to kick in, and then it no longer becomes a kind of a vocational aid. It becomes something that actually harms your vocation.
My guest is journalist Frank Owen, and he's the author of the new book, No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. Your book is in part a history of meth, mm-hmm. And, you know, you trace how it spread. And the accessibility of meth has had a lot to do with how easy it used to be to make it.
Right.
Tell us about how meth is made and why it was easy before certain prohibitions were put into effect, why it was so easy to create a home meth lab.
Well, it was actually the prohibitions that made it easier to make meth, because meth in the old days, back in the 60s and the 70s, was a complicated process. It was made using something called phenylacetone, P2P, and you needed sophisticated laboratory equipment to make it. You couldn't just cook it up at home. But basically, the feds put P2P, made it a controlled substance in 1980, and that forced underground chemists to find out another way to make meth, and that's when they discovered how to make it using ephedrine and pseudoephedrine. And that's the so-called ephedrine reduction method. That is what inaugurated this whole era of so-called kitchen chemistry, because making meth with ephedrine is a lot easier to make than with P2P. You can make meth using just ordinary household items, you know, stuff you can get at the drugstore, stuff you can get at the hardware store. But what's really interesting about that is that the ephedrine reduction method actually makes the drug twice as powerful. So ironically, by cracking down on the old biker meth, the P2P meth, they ended up producing a drug that was not only easier to make, but also was twice as strong.
And it's made from the pseudoephedrine in cold medicine.
Right, right. That's one way to make it. There are other ways, but that's the way kitchen chemists, people who make it in the kitchen or in their garage, that's how they make meth, yes.
So was the chemistry part how to separate the ephedrine from the rest of the cold medicine tablet?
Yeah, I mean, there is. It used to be easy because you used to be able to just buy pure ephedrine tablets. But what happened, of course, is that the pharmaceutical companies caught on to the fact that that people were using these legal medicines to make meth. So they start adding all these kind of harmless additives. So you basically, in order to make it these days using that way, you have to separate out all the gunk that comes with the ephedrine, which actually takes longer than actually making the meth itself.
In your book, you write about the history of meth.
Right.
And it was legal for several decades. When was it legal, and what was it used for?
It was legal right up to 1970. And it was used for a wide variety of ailments. Somebody once totted them all up, and I think it was about 42 different ailments. And it was used for everything from curing hiccups to weight loss, to treating alcoholism, to treating heroin addiction, to treating Parkinson's disease. So it was initially regarded as something of a wonder drug. But eventually, of course, it became really kind of America's first lifestyle drug. After a while, most of the meth being consumed was things like to lose weight, to gain a little bit of energy. Housewives used it a lot, for instance, to treat depression. I mean, methamphetamine was prescribed by doctors quite legally to pregnant women.
Now, you're right that, you know, as an underground drug, meth was at first a biker drug. How did it become a biker drug?
Well, what happens is that a bunch of Korean War veterans in the late 50s come back to the San Francisco Bay Area, and doctors start prescribing injectable methamphetamine to these heroin addicts to wean them off heroin. And again, I know that sounds incredibly strange, but some doctors sincerely believed that by substituting a downer with a strong stimulant, you could actually wean people off heroin. Now, of course, what happened was all these heroin addicts became methamphetamine addicts. So the California Attorney General asked the pharmaceutical companies not to supply injectable methamphetamine to California anymore. And they actually did that. So basically, methadrine, injectable legal methamphetamine, was withdrawn from the market. And in response, the first illegal speed labs, speed is what they used to call methamphetamine, these speed labs sprung up in the San Francisco area. And I mean, basically, the bikers were involved right in the beginning. It was basically like a Korean War veterans. But the bikers were employed essentially as delivery boys. They were used to deliver the drug throughout the rest of California and also into the Midwest and throughout the rest of the United States. Over time, the bikers learned how to make meth, and so then they could control the whole process. They basically made the drug and also transported the drug across the United States. And then that's how they came to control the market.
And you said that there were a lot of biker labs in the Ozarks starting in about the mid-70s.
Right. I mean, especially with the old biker meth, the meth that the Hells Angels and the Pagans used to make, that was a very smelly process. It was a big laboratory, and the chemicals used. I mean, P2P was the main chemical used. It's a very, very smelly chemical. So they needed rural areas, and they needed rural areas with very sparse law enforcement presence. And the Ozarks provided the perfect setting for that. I mean, you know, the Ozarks has a long tradition of home distilling that goes back, you know, centuries. So it kind of fit right in the Ozarks. It was easy to set these labs up there, to hide them, you know, in pig farms or in other, you know, out-of-the-way locations. And so that's why, you know, that's why I think the Angels chose the Ozarks as a major manufacturing center.
You described someone named Bob Palette as having decentralized the local meth trade, and he started making meth himself, and his recipe became known as Nazi dope.
Right.
What was different about his recipe?
Well, what was different about his recipe was that it was a very simple process. He claims that that's how the Nazis made meth during World War II, the meth they supplied to their battlefront troops. I don't think that's the case, but anyway, the name stuck. And basically, what was interesting about this method was it was a simple method that used anhydrous ammonia, which had never been, and lithium metal, which had never been used before in the United States. Now, anhydrous ammonia is a very common chemical in the Ozarks in the spring growing season. You see these white tanks everywhere, which are full of anhydrous ammonia. They're basically used to fertilize the ground. So he, you know, invented this new way of making meth using this chemical that was very easily accessible in the Ozarks. And he kind of taught this method to other people he knew who went on to teach other people who went on to teach other people. So it became like a giant pyramid scheme. And so rather than having to buy meth from the bikers, people, you know, meth addicts and meth users could now make their own meth using chemicals they could find just locally.
But that was kind of dangerous, not only because of the meth itself, but also because anhydrous ammonia is a very explosive chemical. So that means that there was a very dangerous chemical around.
Technically, it's not explosive. It has a very low boiling point. So it basically, what it does is, if it's exposed to air, it turns into this kind of noxious gas that, if it touches the skin, it kind of peels back the skin. So you get, it's like coal burns. You know, it's like if you're in like a really cold environment, that it will kind of burn your skin. And if you inhale it into your lungs, it will frost your lungs, you know. So it doesn't explode. It's not an explosive, but it is very, very dangerous. And there's been numerous deaths reported, you know, because basically what these people do is they go to these tanks with an empty fire extinguisher or one of those propane tanks you get when you go camping, and they decant the anhydrous into these other containers. And if you don't do it properly, the thing will, you know, and you inhale some of the fumes or it leaks out, then it can quite easily kill you.
I guess what you've told us about the Ozarks becoming a kind of capital for meth labs explains how Missouri became such a central place for meth.
Right. I mean, there always was a meth culture in Missouri. I think in the book you see that, you know, there was an article in Time magazine from 1959, and it was about in Oklahoma City, Missouri. It's about these teenagers, you know, injecting meth, and at the time, you could buy it over the counter from chemists. It was called a Valo inhaler, and basically people would use it legitimately for, you know, asthma and breathing problems. And basically you would just break open the container, and you would take the wick inside out, which was, you know, full of pure methamphetamine, and they would dunk it into a cup of hot water, and then they would take a syringe, slurp up the liquid and inject it into their arms. So this was 1959, and this is Time magazine, so you've got to figure if Time magazine discovered it in 1959, it was probably happening several years earlier than that. So we're talking about a problem that had been around for decades, but it was when everybody and the mother could cook their own meth, that's when it really started to become like a crisis in the Ozarks.
My guest is journalist Frank Owen, and his new book is called No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth. And it's a history of meth. In writing about the history of meth, you say that during World War II, all of the sides in the war were using amphetamines for their soldiers. Can you tell us a little bit about how soldiers were using amphetamines in the war?
Well, amphetamine and methamphetamine, it had long been known that they boosted energy, they decreased tiredness, they suppressed hunger, they made you more aggressive. Perfect drug for the battlefield, you know? Didn't have to eat, didn't slow down, could kill and kill and kill. So, yeah, it was a perfect drug. It's also a drug that, as I said before, it's a drug that focuses concentration. So they could actually take the drug without getting too stoned, it wasn't as if they were taking, 500 milligrams. They were taking pill form, so it was like 5, 10, 15 milligram doses. But methamphetamine seemed particularly useful in a battlefront situation because of all those reasons I cited.
One of the people you write about was nicknamed Uncle Fester. His real name is Steve Pressler, is it pronounced?
Pressler. Yeah.
And he was a meth cook in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And he had written a guide for terrorists teaching them how to make things like botulinum, ricin, and sarin gas.
It's called Silent Death.
And then he wrote a recipe book for meth, and that was called Secrets of Methamphetamine Manufacture, a handbook for making crystal meth. So how did this book change meth labs and meth distribution?
Well, up until that point, recipes to make meth were essentially kind of like forbidden knowledge, people passed around these recipes. People paid for these recipes. They were, if you wanted to buy a meth recipe, it would cost you a lot of money. So Secrets of Methamphetamine Manufacture basically was the first book that made these recipes available to the general public, and also the first book where the recipes actually worked, because Pressler's a trained chemist, so he actually knows what he's talking about. Whereas, before, meth manufacturing was a kind of, this kind of practice that was surrounded in myth and legend. Some recipes might work, other recipes wouldn't work, So he kind of almost codified the process of making meth, and the book sold a lot of copies. So, and the book, everywhere you go, basically in the United States, anybody who's making meth in a home lab knows this book, has read this book, or learned to make meth using this book. I mean, there's two ways they learn to cook. They learn to cook by watching other people, or they learn to cook by reading this book.
Did you meet Steve Pressler?
Oh yeah, sure. We spent a boozy weekend together. Like watching wrestling at this local sports bar and talking politics. And yeah, he's a very ordinary guy, very blue collar guy, not at all weird, not strange, not crazy. He could be any blue collar guy in any small town or any city in America, except he writes these incendiary books that, drive the DEA crazy.
Is he still making meth?
No. Well, that's what he tells me. People speculate that he must have some meth lab hidden away because he constantly revises the text, because there's always like new recipes, new ways of making meth. And so he's put out, I think he's on his, sixth, seventh edition now. So people think, oh, he must have a meth lab somewhere. But, he's followed constantly by the DEA and by the local police. So if he really did have a meth lab, I think they would probably know about it. So I take him at his word. He says he hasn't made meth in well over a decade.
Did he seem to have any regrets about having helped so many people become addicts?
No, he takes great pride in it.
Why does he take pride in that?
Well, I think he sees, he's a kind of, I guess what you would call a kind of right-wing anarchist, He really hates the government. because, you know, the government put him in jail for 6 years for manufacturing meth, and he sees this as his way of getting back at the government, that by teaching, you know, all these kids how to make meth, you know, it's payback for the 6 year prison term he did. You know, I mean, he takes no responsibility whatsoever for the kind of negative consequences of this knowledge. As far as he's concerned, he just writes the books, and what people do with that knowledge is up to them.
What are some of the ways that federal government and state governments have cracked down on chemicals that are used to make meth?
Well, basically, every chemical that goes to make meth these days is controlled in some way or another. But the problem is, this is what they call a supply-side measure, right? You can cut off the chemicals, but it does nothing about the demand for the drug. So this recent round of chemical controls, for instance, is the Combat Meth Act, which you may have heard of. And that basically, you know, if you go to Walgreens or your local pharmacy and you want to buy some cold medicines, you have to show ID and you have to sign this form, and you usually have to get it from the manager, and there's this whole rigmarole. Now, the thing about that is, it's been incredibly successful. There's been a huge drop-off in these so-called mom-and-pop labs, these small-time independent operators, massive decrease. But what's happened is that created a void, and so now the Mexican cartels have come in, and they're the ones now supplying all the meth. So what you have is, instead of a situation where you have this patchwork quilt of local meth scenes with these independent operators supplying these local markets, now you have a situation which is actually more like the cocaine business. It's this drug is made abroad, then it's smuggled into the country. And so now you have, instead of the meth trade being controlled by hillbillies and bikers, you have the meth trade controlled by these very sophisticated Mexican polydrug organizations, very violent, whose leaders never even set foot in the country.
So now that Mexican labs and the Mexican crime world has gotten involved with making and distributing meth, that means if you're buying meth that's from the Mexican labs, that you're kind of getting more connected to the criminal underground.
Right.
And also the drug, I believe, has become much more expensive.
Much more expensive and much stronger. One of the ironies of these attempts to suppress meth is the harder they crack down on it, the stronger the drug gets. This drug, that this Mexican ice that you can buy, like where I am at the moment in New York City, it's $240 a gram, and it's like anything from 92 to 98% pure. It will blow your socks off, you know, and it's much more powerful than what these small mom-and-pop labs were making, you know. And, you know, the Mexicans have quality control. Stuff that comes from the small independent operators, it varies greatly, the potency of the drug. You know, it all depends on the skill of the chemist. The Mexican cartels have professional labs with professional chemists, and they're able to deliver the strongest version of meth yet available to the American consumer.
How's the Drug Enforcement Agency trying to deal with Mexican meth?
Well, you know, a lot of it is diplomacy. I mean, you know, the DEA has no jurisdiction in Mexico. So a lot of this occurs at the diplomatic level with the State Department and, you know, trying to get, the Mexican government to crack down on these guys. But, you know, it's not hardly a secret that Mexico is a very corrupt country. And the history of drug trafficking from Mexico into America is that these drug traffickers are protected from on high, you know, the Mexican military, Mexican police, Mexican politicians. So in order to eliminate Mexican meth, you would literally have to reform, you know, the Mexican political structure from top to bottom. So there's a lot of talk about, we'll extradite this drug dealer and that drug dealer. And, you know, the Amezcua brothers, who were the big kingpins of meth in the 1990s, I mean, they eventually imprisoned those guys. But, you know, these guys go to prison, but it doesn't seem to stop meth coming into this country. You can take down, you know, a couple of cartel leaders and others will take their place. So it does seem rather like a kind of something of a losing battle.
When you were researching the new Mexican meth, mm-hmm. You tried it.
Yes.
And I was kind of reading
Mexican
your book.
Mexican ice, they call it.
Yeah, reading your book, I was wondering why you did that. Since you used to have a meth problem, did you feel like it was dangerous to try it again, even if it was, in your mind, just research?
Well, I wanted to try it because it was different from the meth I used to do. The meth I used to do was the old biker meth. And, people have been talking to me about this Mexican ice and saying how powerful it was and, you know, and just how much more different it was from the old meth. And, you know, I was curious to find out, you know, just how powerful it was. And I thought I was being very responsible. I mean, I just bought half a gram. I mean, it was barely covered the bottom of a bag. And I split it up into 8 lines. And I had 2 lines a day for 4 days. And I thought, why? What can go wrong, you know? I mean, these weren't like huge big lines. These were tiny little lines. But, you know, I underestimated just how powerful this drug was. I mean, half a gram, you know, nearly drove me crazy. And it's kind of, you know, it was rather than that chapter, it comes at the end of a chapter which says, you know, that the more they've cracked down on meth, the stronger it's got. And rather than just kind of citing, you know, oh, this is 98% pure compared to like it was 80% pure like 10 years ago, I thought it'd be interesting just to show just how powerful it was. And I think, you know, I think that's what I did do. It's not something I would do again in a hurry. It was extraordinarily powerful.
Well, Frank Owen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frank Owen is the author of No Speed Limit, The Highs and Lows of Meth.